Well, it's good to be here tonight. I appreciate another opportunity to speak. We're going to be in Revelation chapter 17 tonight. Revelation chapter 17. Chapter 17 and 18 of Revelation are probably in the top 50 chapters in the Bible most likely not to be preached on a Sunday. Long time ago, when I had no anticipation of doing a series through the book of Revelation, I anticipated chapter 17 and 18 arriving in my schedule. And I dreaded the moment that it did because I knew vaguely about what was in those chapters, and I thought, how in the world do you apply that to our lives? However, what I found the past couple weeks as I've been searching through these couple chapters is that I not only found a lot that we could learn, but I found a rebuke that was certainly more applicable than I was expecting it to be. So if you follow with me, and if you hang with me, I think this will be a help to you tonight. Chapter 17 and 18, what we've seen just recently before we've gotten to this chapter is chapter 16, which is right before it, where an angel comes, seven angels come, and they pour out the last seven plagues on the world. The very last plague that is poured out on the world, there is no more. He introduces these as the seven plagues, the last ones. There aren't more to follow. There's not going to be seven more angels that are going to line up and give seven more out to the world in this time of great tribulation. In fact, when this last one is poured out, he says, it is done. And then it gives you a brief statement. There's earthquakes and lightning and hail and thunderings and that Babylon falls and the kingdoms become Christ's, and it's all really succinct. What chapter 17 and 18 does, as is Revelation's way, is it expands on those two claims. For chapter 17 and 18, it expands on the fall of all those who have opposed Christ. Chapter 19, it's going to expand in that moment about the triumph of Jesus. And so that's where we are in chapter 17, but while we've been talking about Antichrist, we've been talking about Satan, who is the great dragon in the book of Revelation, but he introduces a new persona in chapter 17, which is the great harlot. So I want us to look down in chapter 17, verse number one. We're just going to read down to verse number six for now. So there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, and I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been drunk with the wine of her fornication. And so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration or astonishment. It's the idea there. Several sermons ago, when we were in chapter 14, I first introduced the term Babylon in the book of Revelation. Babylon is pictured in that chapter as offering its wine to the people of the world, and many of the people of the world are willing to take that. I turned us all the way back to the book of Daniel, and to illustrate the point, put us all at Daniel's table where he sat at the table of Babylon and chose not to drink of Babylon's wine. And here we see her with a golden cup in her hand, filled with all the abominations of the world, offering to the world, and many will drink of it. But I didn't point us back to where I could have, because I knew chapter 17 was coming. Because we should have asked this question: why is Babylon the personification of the wicked world system? Why that? Why not Persia or Greece? Or Rome, for that matter. That would have been appropriate for the time of John writing this book. If he would have said that this is great mystery Rome, everyone would have understood the wickedness that that's assigned to. Why Babylon? Because Babylon does not begin in the book of Daniel and Jeremiah. In fact, historically, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon is even known as the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the new one. And you can't have a new one unless you have an old one. Because the story of Babylon doesn't begin in Daniel. The story of Babylon begins all the way back in Genesis. So I want you to turn there. Genesis chapter 10. We're going to be in chapter 17 of Revelation for the rest of our time, but I want you to turn to Genesis 10 really quickly. 10 and 11. Mankind was destroyed in chapter 6 because of the wickedness, the intense wickedness of man. The thoughts and imaginations of their heart were only evil continually. And God gave them all a new start. Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth, they all had the opportunity to repopulate the earth in the righteousness of Christ and following the Lord the way they should have. And so we have a genealogy in chapter 10, and we introduce in verse number 8 of chapter 10 a guy as he goes by. Cush, verse number 8 of chapter 10, begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calna, in the land of Shinar. He expands on that story in chapter 11. So turn to chapter 11, verse number 1. The whole earth was of one language and of one speech. It came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. They dwelt there. They said to one another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, slime had they for mortar. And they said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. The Lord said, behold, the people is one. They have all one language. This they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they've imagined to do. Go to, let us go down and there confound their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did therefore confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. Now what we should see in chapter 11 is a moment of mercy. Last time we saw mankind directly disobey what God told him to do, they were destroyed by the flood. And here, the very next version of this, all he does is just put them in a situation where it's a lot easier for them to obey. Now, usually within this story, all we see is one simple step of disobedience. God told them to spread and multiply, and they just didn't. But it's more than that. They stayed together to build a tower, to reach into heaven, to make a name for themselves. I thought this would be appropriate. This is very long, but I thought it would be helpful. Josephus, who is a Jewish historian, records the story that we just read. And traditionally, there's a lot of little pieces that he puts along with it that all the Jews understand. This is what Babylon means. This is what Babel means. So I'm going to read it to you very quickly. This is Josephus' version of this same story. The sons of Noah were three, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, born 100 years after the deluge. These, first of all, descended from the mountains into the plains. They fixed their habitation there. They persuaded others who were greatly afraid of those lower grounds on account of the flood, and so were very loath to come down from the higher places, to venture to follow their examples. The plain in which they first dwelt was called Shinar. God commanded them to send colonies abroad for the thorough peopling of the earth, that they might not raise seditions among themselves, but might cultivate a great part of the earth and enjoy its fruit after a plentiful manner. But they were not so ill instructed that they did not obey God, for which reason they fell into calamities and were made sensible by experience of what sin they had been guilty. For when they had flourished with a numerous youth, God admonished them again to send out colonies. But they, imagining the prosperity they enjoyed was not derived from the favor of God, but supposing that their own power was the proper cause of the plentiful condition they were in, did not obey him. Nay, they added to this their disobedience to the divine will the suspicion that they were therefore ordered to send out separate colonies. that being divided asunder, they might the more be easily oppressed. Now, it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God as if it was through his means they were happy, but to believe it was their own courage which procured their happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God but to bring them into constant dependence on his power. He also said he would be revenged on God if he should have a mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach, and that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers. The multitude were very ready to follow the determination of Nimrod, to esteem it a piece of cowardice to submit to God. And they built a tower, neither sparing any pains, nor being in any degree negligent about the work. And by reason of the multitude of hands employed in it, it grew very high sooner than any could expect. And when God saw that they acted so madly, he did not resolve to destroy them utterly, since they were not grown wiser by the destruction of the former sinners. But he caused a tumult among them by producing in them diverse languages, and causing that, through the multitude of those languages, they should not be able to understand one another. The place wherein they built the tower is now called Babylon. Babylon, I will build my own destiny. Babylon, I will procure my own happiness. I will protect my own future. I will live above God's judgment. I will make a name for myself. I will exert great energy and take great pains and will invent new inventions and work my fingers to the bone to exalt myself. This is Babylon, and Babylon always brings confusion. It's true that Babylon, that spirit of Babylon, the exaltation of myself, has existed ever since. And so when you turn to Revelation, the last book in the Bible, it reminds you of the first book of the Bible and says, do you know what mankind's problem is? The desire to exalt himself. Why is it in chapter 17? Because chapter 17 and 18 is about that which Christ triumphs over. And when we are willing to follow Christ, that's when we have to put ourselves to the side. Christ is only triumphing in our life when we are not the ones who's the king of our own destiny. So how much do you serve Babylon? Because God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. He abases those who exalt themselves. But ask yourself those same questions. How often do I find myself trying to forge my own destiny instead of that which God has set before me? How often do I attempt to procure my own happiness through the tedium of my own devices? How often do I try to protect my own future through the work of my own hands rather than simply through the obedience to the Lord? How often do I try to avoid the judgment of God by just taking care of myself instead? How often is my goal to make a name for myself? Because the extent to which that is true in my life is the extent to which I serve Babylon. This is Babylon, and we can easily become deceived by that great harlot and find ourselves committing spiritual adultery with the world out of love for myself. This chapter gets so consumed with all the end times conversations as this great harlot, the personification of a last world religion, probably. And then we have a lengthy conversation of, is it the Catholic Church or is it the Muslims? And I think we're really asking the wrong question. The question is not, what is Babylon out there? The question is, where is Babylon in here? And so very as quickly as I can, I'm going to give you, in this chapter, we're going to read through it, six descriptions of Babylon that reveal what we are truly facing in the dark shadows of our own hearts. So number one, our self-exaltation always lives in the wilderness. In the wilderness. What's really interesting about this chapter is that John, believe it or not, has only been, so to speak, in two places since the book has begun. God transports him to let him see what's going on. And if you pay very close attention to the book of Revelation, by the way, you can turn back to Revelation 17. We're done with Genesis. I just wanted you to see that. In Revelation, in the whole book, he only is put in a couple different locations. Of course, at the very beginning, he's on Patmos, talking to the Lord, hearing his conversations to the seven churches. And then at the beginning of chapter 4, an angel comes to him and says, "Come up hither." And he transports John to heaven, where he has seen everything from chapter 4 through chapter 16. All of it has been from the viewpoint of heaven. He sees what's happening in the world. He sees the angels in heaven. He sees what's happening down below, destruction. He sees the conversations before the throne. That's the viewpoint to which John has been until chapter 17. This is the first time that an angel picks up John and he moves him. In order for John to get a good view of the great harlot of Babylon, he must take him, in verse 3, into the wilderness. I don't think it's by accident. Now, we could just say that's the desert, that's where Babylon is, and maybe so. But in the Bible, the wilderness is always a picture of desolation and death. The wilderness is always a picture of the place of hardship. It is always a picture of the place that's not the promised land. J.A. Seiss says this about that moment. Where spiritual harlotry occupies the place of true worship of God, there is desolation. There may be riches, worldly glory, as here. There may be fullness of power and dominion. There may be purple and scarlet and gold and gems of stone and pearls and drink from golden cups. There may be luxuries, sumptuous living, pomp, display, and everything to delight the sensual heart. And yet, where the word and worship and institutes of God are trampled underfoot, it is wilderness. It doesn't matter that the great woman is clothed with glory and purple and scarlet. She has chosen to exalt herself above the Lord. And the spirit of Babylon is that which chooses me over God, and it describes it as unfaithfulness to our God. And he says that can only thrive in the wilderness. We must come to grips with the truth that Babylon, the desire to build our own tower, forge our own destiny, and define our own right and wrong, is a life that is always drinking, but is never, the thirst is never quenched. Always eating, but is never filled. Always searching, but never finds. Babylon can only be built in the wilderness, and in the wilderness, there is death. Every time the wilderness is compared to the promised land, it says Christians choose the wilderness in spite of the promised land being in front of them because they choose their way instead of God's way, and they will experience loss and suffering, and this is where we find the great harlot in chapter 17. Not a surprise. Self-exaltation must live in the wilderness. Number two, exaltation of oneself promises what our flesh desires. Promises what our flesh desires. Look at verse 4. How does he describe this woman? The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. I mean, it can't be so bad. Purple and scarlet, all those are signs of wealth and royalty. She's decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. She drinks from a golden cup. Of course, that is the cup of Babylon that she offers to the world. Why do so many travelers go down that same path in that same stretch of wilderness? Because exalting myself always promises what my flesh desires. When I was reading this, I thought of Proverbs chapter 7. The strange woman, remember that proverb? It spans the whole chapter, which is very infrequent for Proverbs, by the way. Where the simple man goes down to the street to her corner, and she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent face said unto him, "This day I've paid my vows." She talks about how her bed is decked with coverings of tapestry and fine works of Egypt and spices. And the goodman's not at home. He's gone on a long journey. And so with her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. And with the flattering of her lips, she forced him like an ox that goeth to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. And the whole chapter ends by saying, when he followed after his flesh, he did not know that it was for his life. So he says, hearken unto me now, therefore, O ye children, attend to the words of thy mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways, go not astray in her paths, for she has cast down many wounded, yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. I don't think it's an accident. This strange woman is talking in the very practical terms of an actual prostitute, actually prostituting herself for the desires of her flesh. But I don't think it's an accident that this is the same type of picture he carries over all the way, Revelation chapter 17. But there he calls her Babylon, because the desire to promote myself is a very similar desire to everything else that is appeasing to my flesh, because it makes me feel good to forge my own destiny, to do as I please. The strange woman lieth at every corner. This great harlot is in every store you go to, every website you visit, and every job you're employed with, and in every group of friends that you might take. She promises to satiate your lust. She promises it will be sweet, and promises there will be no consequences. And she has cast down many wounded. The same thing is true of those who try to promote themselves. The story of the Bible ending in the story of Revelation is that those who promote themselves over God, those who are more concerned with their name rather than God's name, lose. No matter how beautiful it looks along the way, it's just heading towards destruction. Self-exaltation promises what our flesh desires. Number three, self-exaltation hides in all the spiritual adultery of mankind. This self-exaltation hides in all the spiritual adultery of mankind. The name of this great harlot is very telling. Look at verse 5. Upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. She is not every harlot, every unfaithfulness. She is the mother of all of them. Spiritual adultery is unfaithfulness to God in our beliefs and our systems and our actions. That's what it is. That's how it's brought up throughout the whole Bible. Those of you who are in my Jeremiah Sunday School class, that's how he poses that to the Israelites. You have committed spiritual adultery with me because you've been unfaithful but into following me. Instead of obeying me, you've obeyed yourself. That's how she's pictured here. But she's not pictured as just one of them. She's pictured as the mother of every single version of that that has ever been produced in this world. Every abomination of the earth all goes back to that mindset of Babylon. I will exalt my own name. I will forge my own destiny. I will define my own right and wrong. I will do as I please. That is the mother of every form of unfaithfulness to God. All of it. From the beginning, even until now. All of those problems can have its root, can find its root in self-exaltation. This is true in the paganism of this world. All of the bad systems of beliefs. But it's also true in every bad version of Christianity around this world. Because sometimes we don't recognize it, do we? There's a reason why she's not just called the mother of harlots. There's a reason she's called Mystery Babylon. Mystery means secret. Because the spirit of exalting myself is a very deceptive thing and can creep into a lot of things that call itself good, but is not. All the bad versions of Christianity, too, are abominations to the Lord. Whether it be Catholicism that somehow finds justification in exalting countless humans to be venerated by other people. Whether it is all of the other versions of Christianity that says you must work your way into God's presence, or maybe we could say you can build your own tower that reaches unto heaven. Or whether it's Mormonism that actually teaches that you can be a god if you do it right. Prove me wrong. I'm not putting words in their mouth. That is their system. It is to say, I can be I will do as I please. I will forge my own destiny. I will define right and wrong. I will make a name for myself. That's what the Bible says is all the versions of running away from God can be found in that. All of it. It all boils down to whether or not you're going to be God or God's going to be God. All of it. Look at verse number one. It says this. Seven angels, which have the seven vials, talk with me. Come hither, I'll show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters. I'll get to that in a second. Verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. Go down to verse number 15. What does he mean by many waters? He saith unto me, verse 15, the waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. This spirit pervades every civilization that you can find. All people, all multitudes, all nations, all tongues, all have her influence. Look at verse 18. The woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And there's an eschatological aspect to that. We'll pull that out in just a minute. But the whole point when it defines them is it tries to universalize this picture. Why? Because it's a universal problem. Self-exaltation is found in every form of spiritual unfaithfulness, which is a very scary thought, because that means it can quite easily be found in my own life. We can easily take chapter 17, and understandably so, and make it all out there and all later. But chapter 17 says you can't do that. She sits on many waters. She has influenced many people, many nations, many languages, many kings. Many have been cast down by her. This is not just a later problem. This is a now problem. We're going to see that in a second, too. The Bible warns of all these bad thinking, all this way of bad thinking in the future. It calls these things doctrines of devils. But in 2 Timothy chapter 3, when he talks about the perilous times that will come, do you know the very first thing that he says? For men shall be lovers of their own selves. They will be lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. They have a form of godliness. It's cloaked well. They just deny the power thereof. Says this is not a new problem, and it's also not a problem out there. Number four, self-exaltation is willing to destroy truth for its own sake. Look at verse number six. I'm going to get to the hard part here in just a second, so don't worry. We will get there. Verse number six, I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. This is such a vivid and gross picture. remember a few chapters ago, was it last chapter? I think it was, with the vials. Yes. Yeah. When they poured out those different judgments on the earth, and one of them, two of them, was that they made all the fresh water into blood and all they made all the salt water into blood so that all the water is blood. But not just any blood, the blood of dead men. And he says that you're righteous, O Lord, because they've spilled the blood of saints, and so that's what they would drink. They were given blood of dead men to drink. But here, what is so gross is that the harlot is found not drinking the blood of people because that's the only water there's to find, but that is what she chooses to fill her cup with. Why saints and martyrs, all those who stood for truth, she chose to take out of her way and willingly took the consequences for it? When I read that, and then when I wrote that in my notes, a story came to my mind. Because I thought, nobody does that, though. But a story came to my mind that was all too similar. The crowd pressed together, all trying to fit itself into Pilate's room. And they pushed Jesus to the front. Pilate questions Jesus and finds no fault with him. he says to the crowd that he wouldn't be guilty of the blood of this innocent man. That was why he washed his hands. And how did the people respond? I mean, they wanted to forge their own destiny. They wanted to define right and wrong on their own. Jesus got in the way of that. So what did they say to Pilate? Let his blood be upon us and our children. I will willingly take the consequences of pushing truth out of the way in so much as I am able to determine truth for myself. And so for the rest of history, it will be recorded that those people stood in that moment and said the words, I will take the blood of Jesus on my own head. They said that. And we would say, I would never do that, but often we are so blinded by our own intention to build our own future, to make a name for ourselves, to determine right and wrong on our own, to not let God be God so that we can be God. We're willing to push truth aside because Babylon is lurking in our hearts more than we'd like to admit. We don't realize how willing we often are to silence truth and take the consequences so that we can give ourselves happiness in our own way. And this is what she does. This is what the people in Pilate's hall do. And this is what we are often more willing to do than we should be. Self-exaltation is willing to destroy truth. Number five, we're getting there. We have only six. This is the longest one because this is the one that's the most complicated. This is the section that almost introduces more questions than it answers, but I'm going to do my best, okay? Number five, self-exaltation desires power. Desires power. This short section is got a lot going on, so hang with me. First of all, we notice that in verse number two, this great harlot is connected to all the kings of the earth. But then this is really important. Look at verse number three. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. So if you got a clue in anytime during the sermon, you got to really key in here because you can get lost really quick. So the woman is not the beast with seven heads and 10 horns. She's riding the beast with seven heads and 10 horns. Why is that important? Because then you should ask yourself this question reading through the book of Revelation, am I familiar with a beast that has seven heads and 10 horns? And the answer to that question should be, yes, you are. Because you have met two already in this book that have seven heads and 10 horns. The last one was the Antichrist. But the reason that they used that picture for the Antichrist in his world kingdom was it was trying to refer back to one chapter before, where it was first introduced as the great dragon, who is Satan himself. But it never defines what he means by seven heads and 10 horns, so we just have to take for granted that that's important, and he'll define it now. What are the seven heads and 10 horns? We're going to see that in a second. Verse number seven. I've read the whole section, verse 1-6. Verse number seven. The angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? Because he was astonished. I will tell thee in the mystery of the woman and the beast that carrieth her, which hath the seven heads and 10 horns. The beast does. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. Ugh, okay. And that's one of those annoying phrases you read and you're like, really? You could have made that almost any bit easier than you did. Now, I think what it's trying to do, was and is not and yet is most likely a reference to chapter 13, where that beast is said to have been killed with a deadly wound and then yet continue. And there was something marvelous about how he had a deadly wound and continued to go on. He was, then he's not, but yet he is. Okay. Now, here is the mind, verse 9, which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. There are seven kings. Five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short time. Now the temptation for a lot of people is to make the seven mountains Rome, the city of seven hills. However, according to this passage, he says that five of them have been, one of them is, and another of them will come. So there is a spectrum of time passing. John is writing this in the first century. So he is the is. So five of them are before him. Okay? The book of Daniel records four different major kingdoms. Thing is, Daniel started with the present and worked forward. Revelation starts in the future and works back. Before the time that is, there are five major wicked, ungodly kingdoms. You have Egypt, Assyria, New Babylon, Persia, and Greece. They were before. Then you have John, is, Rome, six. Then you have one that will come, and he will continue a short space. That is the new world ruler's kingdom. These seven heads are seven kingdom systems. Now you have 10 horns. Look at verse 11. Oh, actually, no, we're not there yet. The beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. The new world order that will come out of the Antichrist time will not be enough for him. That new united system around will, he won't have absolute power. One day he wants absolute power, and is out of those kingdoms that come the last, Kingdom 7, 2.0. And this is the one where the Antichrist has absolute rule. Now, that's actually really important to a point I'm going to make here at the end of the sermon. What about the 10 horns? The 10 horns, verse 12, which thou callest, are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. So, what do we know? The seven heads and the 10 horns is picturing seven major wicked, ungodly systems of men, kingdoms. The 10 horns are 10 kings that all rule at the same time at the end. And we see this picture, seven heads and 10 horns, hanging out with the Antichrist. But it's first given the seven heads and 10 horns are put on Satan himself. Why does he do that? Because he wants us to recognize that all these kingdoms of men are raised and lowered because Satan is trying to work his plan. These world powers, these wicked kingdoms who have spilled the blood of those who speak the truth, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, no good things does the Bible have to say about any of those. All of these have been satanically influenced. So we know that. But we also know that throughout all these kingdoms, the seven heads and 10 horns, riding on the back of this beast is Babylon. Throughout all of these kingdoms of men is this spirit. I will build my own tower. I will make a name for myself. I will procure my own happiness. I will define right and wrong. I will chart my own future. There's a reason why that woman rides the beast of all kingdoms of men. She sits on many waters. She has influenced many kings. Because it's found in all of those decisions that men have made to put themselves on top of the world. J.A. Seitz says this, dragon agencies are ill at ease without some form of dragon worship. Only what will dignify, if not deify, lust and selfishness is in accord with their spirit. It's a sad commentary on humanity, but it is the truth. That all great world powers from first to last are the paramours and the props of the harlot woman. History itself, according to Revelation 17, and all the major movements of mankind can be summed up with this, men trying to build their own tower. And is that not true? Willing to do anything, willing to push anyone aside, in order to make a name for themselves. And you and I, we just end up playing right into the system. That the greatest success that I can be is to just build my own tower as high as I can make it. Make my name as prevalent as I can. do as much as I can, have as much freedom as I can to do as I please. That would be success and freedom. And we play right into the system. Now, is that a actual final world religion? I think it is. But the spirit that's there is no different than the spirit that's gone before. I will do as I please. It desires power and rides the power. But this takes me to the last one, which struck me more than almost any of the other ones, because I was not expecting it to come. Number six, self-exaltation is self-destructive. From this last point, we should note a tension. The woman rides the beast. The beast is the Antichrist, or empowered by the dragon himself. All those satanically influenced world powers, all the way up to the last one with that union of 10 kings. So who is in charge in this picture? The beast or the harlot? Satan or the spirit of Babylon? Has mankind deceived Satan into letting man use Satan's power and influence so that Babylon can build its own tower? Or has Satan capitalized on man's intense desire to make a name for himself in order to drive world history towards Satan's goals at man's expense? That's the question that I had. The woman rides the beast. Who is in charge? What is the last system? The woman rides the beast with seven heads. But remember, we just saw a minute ago that the very, very, very last system is an eighth one. Did you notice that? The eighth one comes out of the seven. So there seems to be one last system in which mankind and his intense desire to make a name for himself somehow seems to be missing out of. What is this very, very last system on the timeline that he's speaking of? Well, according to Revelation chapter 13, where all religions may have become one, all man's harlotries are brought together and justified collectively, after that, the very last world religion and world belief and world system is where all mankind must bow before Satan himself. Remember that? He made an image and forced everyone to bow to it and give obeisance to it. The Bible says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, speaking of that moment, he says, "Let no man deceive you by any means. That day shall not come, except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or all that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God." Listen, Satan has not been helping mankind build man's kingdom. He's been building his kingdom. And when he does not need man, he will abandon her. This is what I was not expecting. Look at verse 16. So you have the woman riding the beast with seven heads. Then you have an eighth one. The woman has clothes with scarlet and purple, gold, precious stones. She has everything the flesh could desire. And then we get to the end of the chapter, verse 16. The 10 horns, those are the 10 kings at the very end. They're all going to rally around the Antichrist and give him what he wants. "Which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire." She was rich, covered in gold, precious stones, and pearls, purple and scarlet, but when Satan no longer needs man's ambitions to build his kingdom, then he will allow them to be desolate and have nothing. Satan is perfectly willing to let you build your own tower, because at the end of the day, when we're building our own tower, we're actually building Satan's tower. When we're making a name for ourselves or think we are just making Satan's name greater than it deserves to be. When we are not letting God define right and wrong, we're not defining right and wrong. We're letting Satan define right and wrong for us. There is a reason why all false doctrine is called the doctrines of devils. It's not for our sake. It's for his. We are self-destructing. We think we're going to put ourselves on top of the world, but Satan has no need of you. And Satan does not care about you. And it's not the end of his goal in order to put your name in lights. It's at the end of his story. His goal ends there. That's where he's heading, to put himself on the top of the mountain. That's why he fell. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. He says, I will be like the Most High. And every time we choose to have the spirit of Babylon, we choose to join his kingdom. And at the end of it all, the woman is not clothed in gold and precious stones and pearls and decked in costly array. She is naked and desolate. And that's where Satan leaves every person who wants to build their own tower. At the end of the day, though, even if everything I just said was not true, that's still the end result. Because even the beast himself is defined as being destroyed in this chapter. We just read verse 16, but he says in verse 17 that their destruction of that great harlot, Babylon, God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. So this is all part of God's plan anyway. They're just playing into it. This whole chapter, we must remind ourselves why chapter 17 is here. Chapter 17 is not here to remind us about how great Babylon is. Chapter 17 is here to expound on the end of chapter 16, which is this: it is done, and all kingdoms have become Christ. Chapter 17 is just an explanation of that. From beginning to end of this chapter, that's how it starts. Verse number 1 says, let me show you the judgment of this great harlot. Both times, the beast himself, verse number 8, verse number 11, when he describes the beast, he says, the one that goes into perdition, destruction, perishing, ruin. That is where he is going. That's why right in the middle of all of this, he reminds us this very important thing. Verse 14, go back and look at verse 14. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. It doesn't matter that you want to build your own tower and that you want to put yourself on the top, because no version of the story ends with you winning. Look, for he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Do we want to be successful? Then we shouldn't build our own tower. We shouldn't build our own kingdom. We should build Christ's. Because at the end of the story, the city that stands is Jerusalem, the city where God's presence is. It is not Babylon. At the end of the story, the kingdom that lasts is Christ's kingdom, not mine. So if I want to make my life count for something, then I must stop trying to build my own tower. I must stop trying to build my own kingdom and my own name. Because Christ's kingdom stands and Babylon's always falls.